nobody had scored a run on the Dodgers pitching staff in almost a week. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Monday, October 14th. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. Follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. Welcome back to the show, Christian Rau. You can follow him on Twitter at Christian S. Rau, R-A-U-H. And Christian, you came back just in time because holy cow. The NLCS starts off in just dominant fashion. Los Angeles Dodgers roll the New York Mets 9-0 last night. And I don't even really think it was as close as the score makes it sound. We're going to get into the scoreless streak from the bullpen. We're going to, you know, and the pitching staff in general. We're going to get into the offensive performances. We're going to get into the injuries. But first, the Mets have been the team of vibes all postseason, right? They just somehow kept making it happen. Have the Dodgers taken the vibes from the Mets with this win?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the fact that Wendy's dropped the Krabby Patty secret formula, so now that Grimace doesn't have his secret power anymore. I don't know if that's the case, but the Mets mojo definitely went away in game one of the NLCS. So maybe we blame it on Wendy's. I don't know. Their social media team is really good. Maybe we should actually tag them in that portion. Regardless, though, Lindsey, this was a wild way to start NLCS game one. The Mets have had that swag, just like you've mentioned, all playoffs long, and they kind of got a nice, humble welcoming to the NLCS. There's been a moment and multiple moments heading into this one where the Dodgers were seen as underdogs, and we've known what this Dodgers team has been all season long, what they have on their roster. If you look at their first three, even with an injured Freddie Freeman, it's pretty crazy. But I think they proved, okay, look at this is a real team. This is the Los Angeles Dodgers, the team we spent, you know, a gazillion dollars on to get to this point. Let's prove why we're in this position. 9-0 in game one was certainly a statement for that.
Yeah. I do want to point out real quick to anybody listening, they were never underdogs. Just for the record. The number one seed, $1.4 billion in the offseason. They just like to talk about being underdogs for some reason because they have to motivate themselves. It's kind of like how Philly has to find grievance about everything, every possible way to try to fuel themselves, and they still get knocked out in the first round.
Fair enough. I will say this, though, and this was probably just to help create the narrative on MLB Network leading up to the series. They kept saying they felt really strong about the Mets winning this series. So maybe that's what they were going off of, but that could just been helping them create the narrative.
Yeah, so I guess let's look at the Dodgers side of this first. The Dodgers, obviously, like I said, 9-0. They hold the Mets to 3 hits. They allow a grand total of, I believe it's 6 base runners, because 3 walks, 3 hits in the game. And they are now tied with the 1966 Orioles for the longest scoreless streak ever in a single postseason at 33 innings. And fun fact here, that 66 Orioles team did it in the World Series against the Los Angeles, against the Dodgers. I think that's the funny part there. They swept the 66 World Series. The Orioles did 3 straight shutouts to end the series, but the Dodgers now have 3 straight shutouts of their own. Game 4, game 5 against the Padres, now game 1 against the Mets. And with all of the injuries that we've seen for this Dodgers team, Tyler Glasnow's not coming back this year. Walker Buehler's been iffy. You have Emmett Sheehan's out for the year. Tony Gonsolin, Dustin May. They just announced Gavin Stone is out for all of 2025 after shoulder surgery. How improbable was it that not only were you able to go a scoreless game for the 3rd consecutive game, but you got something like Jack Flaherty gave you 7 scoreless innings?
Yeah, just imagine if they never traded for Flaherty, right? Like where they'd be at in this situation right now. I don't know if you're in the NLCS if you don't have Jack Flaherty right now. But what they've shown and what they've overcome in just this short amount of time, because the injuries really started stacking on in, what, September-ish for the most part, Lindsey?
August,
with
September,
the Glasnow injury, Clayton Kershaw, all that good stuff. So Yeah, I would say that this is really impressive. And what we have seen from this Dodgers pitching staff has been really, really impressive. And what they are doing to these Mets team to start off the series is, if I'm the Mets, I got to feel embarrassed. I got to be riding into game two with a chip on my shoulder, knowing that, you know, it's do or die. Like, you can't go down 2-0 against the Dodgers. I don't think you can. I really don't think that there's a scenario of you making a comeback if you go down 2-0, especially how they lost the game last night. The top of your order didn't get a single hit. Mark Vientos, the guy who has changed your entire landscape to the postseason, Lindsay, struck out 3 times in this one. Your only hits were at the bottom of the lineup. You can't have that going into the game two moving forward on Monday. It just can't happen. No way.
Yeah, Francisco Lindor, second time up, he drew a walk in the fourth inning, first base runner of the game for the Mets in the fourth inning. And at that point, it was already 3-0 and was about to become 6-0. And I want to flip over to that side real quick, because Kodai Senga gets the game one start and just really looked bad. They said that they gave him the start because of what he did in the NLDS, the 2 innings. They thought he looked good and that he was back from all of the injuries. He had the shoulder issue in spring training. He had the calf strain. He struggled with his mechanics as he was trying to come back from the injury. But from the very beginning, Senga didn't look good. 13 of his first 16 pitches outside the strike zone. Velocity doesn't get above 94. 2.5 miles an hour slower than what he was doing on October 5th in the NLDS. Average fastball velocity ended up a full mile an hour slower, right? Didn't throw his sweeper at all. And, I mean, walked 3 batters consecutively in the first inning. 2 runs score on, I think it's a Max Muncy single, scores 2 runs. They end up getting another run on him there. In the start of the second inning. And Dave Roberts was very, very frank after the game about how Senga just wasn't there. The quote was, "I thought you could see clearly that Senga just didn't have his A stuff tonight. The split was non-competitive. He didn't use his sweeper. He was just relying on the cutter, working behind hitters and walking guys." In retrospect, at the end of this series, are we going to come back and say the decision to hold Sean Manaea for game 2, meaning that he's not available for a game 5, is that going to, and Senga is the one with this bad start here, is that going to end up being the wrong decision? Or, sorry, is that going to end up being the reason the Mets lose this series? Or it doesn't matter who your starter is if you only pick up 3 hits?
Yeah, that's where I'm sitting there. It's like, it doesn't really matter if your offense isn't doing anything, but the availability of Manaea late in the series might be hurtful. But I'll be honest with you, I don't know if we get that far into the series if the Mets offense doesn't wake up. So that might not even matter in the long run.
Yeah, they have to force a game 5. Yeah.
Right. But the big thing here is Senga in my mind, because even though they thought he looked good in that series against who did they just play?
The Phillies.
My God. I wasn't that impressed. Now, he just was coming back from injury. That's your first time pitching since you pitched only 5 2/3 in the regular season. You had to think there was going to be some sort of rust somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. Why would you let it happen in the NLCS? I know that you're
in game one to open the series too.
Right. I know the Mets pitching staff has struggled themselves, and they've had a lot of luck themselves this year with what their pitching staff has done. I think their luck just finally ran dry with the Senga things coming in. Yeah, I wasn't very hopeful when I heard Senga was starting, and especially when it's going against Flaherty. Flaherty's been one of the hottest pitchers in the playoffs so far. So heading into this one, I mean, what was the last strikeout that Flaherty had before the game in game one? It was the Manny Machado telling him to go sit the F back down, right? He was hot. He was ready to roll. And that's
he had the vibes.
He did. Yeah. You were talking about the Mets having the mojo. Yeah. All the vibes were Jack Flaherty at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah. And all right. So with this now, obviously Manaea game 2, it looks like you'd have Luis Severino for game 3. I'm perfectly fine with holding Severino and giving him the extra rest by putting him on game 3. He's 100 innings over his workload from last year. He's not been good recently. Last five games, he's got an ERA over 5. So definitely needs the extra time. Jose Quintana in game 4, and then you'd come back around. The issue to me here is David Peterson came in for Senga, threw 40 pitches, which means he's out for at least game 2. You don't get him back until the series moves. But you do have the option now, if you want to, where Peterson can be the starter for game 5 over Senga, and you can maybe look at using Senga in a relief capacity. In essence, flop those guys. Make Peterson the starter and make Senga a reliever so you don't have to mess with your roster mix. Either way, it's just it. I think in retrospect, it was obviously a rough and disastrous decision to start Senga, and it is probably going to have repercussions for the rest of the series, because now you have that you're missing that key lefty in your pen.
Yeah, we keep talking about all season long how impressive this Mets rotation has been, and it might be the death of them once it's all said and done, talking about the management of this rotation. It's going to be a really fun conversation to have this offseason if that's how it runs down. But I'll say this about Peterson. He's had a fantastic postseason, except last night. I was not impressed with last night's outing from him. Before the record, the Dodgers were just ready to roll. They were ready to roll last night. Every pitcher that came up to them, with the exception of Reed Garrett for an inning, they had their number. They looked really good against them.
And even Reed Garrett gave up a hit. He just didn't give up any runs. So this was definitely obviously a dominant win, but little bit of concerns for the Dodgers in this. Gavin Lux leaves this game early due to injury. So now you're in a situation where Miguel Rojas is already not on the roster because he's dealing with that adductor issue. Gavin Lux has this hip tightness. You're in a situation now where if you don't have Lux, which Manaea in game 2, he's a lefty, you probably weren't going to play Lux anyway. But now you're in a situation, Edmonds, your starter at short. Mookie Betts has to come back into second base unless you think you can play Chris Taylor all game, which Chris Taylor does not have a hit in the postseason. He has not looked good at all this year. Your options are Kike Hernandez, Mookie Betts. That's really about it. So how concerned should Dodgers fans be about if they don't have Lux by game 3? Is it something, can you get by with Kike Hernandez because he's a different dude in the postseason who's batting .286 with an OPS of almost 1,000? Or is this something where we need to be concerned because your only options are Betts, Kike, and whatever is left of Chris Taylor's career?
Yeah, and Kevin Kiermaier, too. I think Kevin Kiermaier is a really nice piece into this conversation. He was added to the roster because of the Rojas injury. I will say this, selfishly, I'm really glad to see him playing baseball again because his defense is so fun to watch. The way he plays deep and just to create so much space, I think that is a big key indicator. His bat hasn't been super great. So that's something you'll obviously have to take from. So maybe you use him as a defensive replacement. Maybe you can use him and Hernandez battling back in center field. But I do think the answer is going to be moving Mookie Betts back into the infield. I think that's going to be the answer for the game 2 and maybe game 3, unless they decide to put Hernandez there. That's what they did last night once the injury happened. Kiermaier went to center and they moved Hernandez to second and then eventually third base. Now he played three positions. Yeah. In that game
when they pulled Freddie to give Freddie's ankle some rest, they moved Muncy over to third. So Taylor went in the second and Kike went over to third. Yeah.
Right. Which obviously is not going to happen if the game's close. Freddie Freeman's going to stay in. But, so what I expect it will probably wind up being, they'll probably want to keep Mookie where he's at because, let's be honest, Mookie Betts is a great outfielder. If you can keep Mookie Betts out in, he plays right field normally. If he plays right field, and then you can put Kike Hernandez at second. You have Edmund at short. I think you're going to be okay. But losing the bat of Gavin Lux, I think that's something that we're going to talk about that might be very important at the bottom of the lineup, especially if the Mets offense wakes up. Because it's bound to happen. You have to think so, Lindsay, because what they've done in this postseason, they were down to their last breath against the Milwaukee Brewers. And now they are not looking great against this Los Angeles Dodgers team. But if you remember, there was a same situation, a same scenario just about 5 years ago, 2019, the Washington Nationals were down to their last breath against the Milwaukee Brewers, and they didn't start off great against the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they found a way to win the World Series. I'm not saying that's going to happen this time, but it sounds awfully familiar about what we saw just 5 years ago.
Yeah, definitely makes a lot of sense. So tonight, game two in LA, I say tonight, it's a day game, 4:08 p.m. Eastern, which means obviously it's going to be, you know, it's going to be one, it's just after 1 o'clock LA time. I'm sure they're thrilled about that. On Fox and FS1, again, Sean Manaea goes for the Mets. TBD as of now for the Dodgers. We don't know what the plan is. Could be a bullpen game. We're just not 100% sure. I haven't seen anything as of this morning. It's probably come out somewhere, but not been confirmed yet. After that, you get Yankees and Guardians in game one. Alex Cobb versus Carlos Rodon. That game is at Yankee Stadium, 7:38 p.m. on TBS. Yankees have to feel like they're the favorite, right?
Yeah, overall, I think so. Yeah, I would say that.
I mean, this is something where Cleveland squeaked by Detroit, right? They managed to get by somehow. And it feels like Cleveland's offense has not been great this postseason outside of that game one, just destruction they had, obviously. I mean, they completely dominated that game one against Detroit. But after that, it feels like the offense hasn't been amazing. At the same time, the Yankees offense hasn't been amazing, but they've gotten enough contributions from other places. Juan Soto is still Juan Soto. And they've been able to do all of this without Aaron Judge doing a lot, you know, offensively to get the team going. And I think the choice to start Rodon, who has not been great in the postseason, ERA is, you know, he's 0-1 against Alex Cobb. This to me is, I think I still have to give the advantage to Rodon, even despite the fact that he's not been great in the postseason. And he wasn't that amazing in the regular season simply because Cobb was not good at all.
Yeah, neither of them had good starts in the postseason so far this year. I think Cobb went three innings and then Rodon was pulled after four. I will say this about Rodon, though. We have seen in the past, now it's been the past, it's been quite some time, where he has controlled the game. He has taken over the game and he has that in him where he can Tarek Skubal-like control the game. Not saying he is on the same level, but in that capacity, if that can happen,
hopefully without the grand slams.
Correct. Yeah. If that can happen, then I think the Yankees are in a great position. And I think that was another great move by Aaron Boone, which I think he's managed this pitching staff quite well so far this postseason. That's something that we'd have never said about Aaron Boone moving
I didn't think I was expecting to say that. Yeah. That Aaron Boone's pressed the right buttons.
He certainly has. It's taken him a very long time to do it, but I think now that he knows his job is maybe on the edge of being kicked, I think that's where it's at. The Aaron Judge thing is quite interesting to me. He started off very slow in the regular season and then woke up. Maybe this is where it finally happens now for him in the postseason. He needed one series to wake up, but he's batting 154 with a 620 OPS. Luckily for him, though, everyone else around him is looking really good. Gleyber Torres is just been outstanding. And how about Giancarlo Stanton? I mean, I guess we probably should have expected this a little bit because he seems to be a different player in the postseason. He has been
back to vintage postseason Giancarlo. Yeah.
And he steals bases now. Like, okay.
You're welcome, Yankees fans. That was all because I talked shade about him on that show. Okay. So this is with Rodon real quick before we get on. I do want to talk about some of that offensive stuff. For Rodon, 9-2, 3.11 ERA at home this year. You're right that the overall body of work hasn't been great, but at home, he's been a much better pitcher. And he did say he wanted to do a job of better controlling his emotions. He peaked a little too early against Kansas City, ended up giving up those four runs in 3 2/3. Looking at the Guardians lineup, Stephen Kwan's been the real constant offensively, leading off. He's doing really well in the postseason. Outside of him, who in this lineup has to get going to give the Guardians a chance to not be down after game one?
Lane Thomas. Lane Thomas seems to be that X factor guy on the Guardians this year, especially in the postseason. He was dreadful getting to the team right after the trade deadline. I thought it was easily the worst trade in, you know, this season for all of the deadline. But yeah, that has changed going into the postseason. He's had some moments, and one of the biggest moments obviously was the Grand Slam against Skubal. But that was the second time he was put up in that game five with the bases loaded. He popped out with some soft contact the first time. He made up for it on the second time with that Grand Slam over Tarek Skubal, the greatest pitcher in the world right now. That hasn't changed, regardless of how you feel after that Grand Slam. But I do think it's Lance Thomas, or excuse me, Lane Thomas. I think that's what it needs to be, especially if you're going to bat him right after Jose Ramirez, because the Yankees are not going to let Jose Ramirez beat them. I'll tell you right now, you know, wherever situations are going to be, if there's a runner in scoring position and it's an interesting at bat with a scenario that Jose Ramirez is up and there's an open base, we're going to see an intentional walk, and Lane Thomas is going to get that opportunity. So that's where I'm taking him to be the X factor in this one for Cleveland.
You know, I'm going to say Jose Ramirez, 3-16 in the postseason, one homer, three RBIs, batting only 188. I think it's Jose Ramirez. I think he's got to get going. He is the most talented player on this offense. He is the kind of emotional heart of this team. One of those super underrated guys. He doesn't get all the attention everybody else gets. Jose Ramirez has to go out there and play like Jose Ramirez is capable of playing. He batted 279 this year with 39 home runs. Where is that guy? If that guy doesn't show up in this series, Cleveland doesn't win. Lane Thomas, I feel like that Grand Slam is one of those things that gets a guy going, right? You've seen Stephen Kwan be good this postseason. There's guys here who can do stuff. Jose Ramirez has to get going, and if he doesn't, this series not only is over, I don't think it makes it to six games. I think at best it's a five-game series if Jose Ramirez doesn't start hitting, because a lot of positions, I think that the advantage goes to the Yankees. I think Austin Wells is doing better than Bo Naylor. You know, you look at second base, I'd take Gleyber Torres over Andre Jimenez. He's taken steps back the last two straight years. Shortstop's kind of a wash, but Volpe has a better record of offense. Third base and left field are the only real positions where the Guardians have an advantage, I guess first base too, over the Yankees, and those guys have to play like that or else this is going to be over relatively quickly.
Speaking of showing up, how many times are we going to see the rocking the baby jester, you think, in this series? How many times? Many. Over, under, or three? You think we're going to see?
I'm going to go over. I mean, this thing, if it's a four-game series, maybe not, but if it's longer than that, we're definitely going to see it more than that. Again, quick reminder on this. This game is at 7:38 p.m., again, on TBS. It's also streamable on Max if you have that as well. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode breaking down both of these games and previewing the ALCS Game 2 for Tuesday night. If you're listening on audio, do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, tell your friends. There's a great place they can go to get daily recaps of Major League Baseball. And until next time, this has been First Pitch.